Welcome to The Better Picture, where we get close, stay focused, and keep shooting. Tonight, and especially tonight, we have some tricks for you on photography. We also have a great treat for you. Samantha Barber is going to be our guest tonight, an assistant professor of all the arts at LSUS, one of our own that is here. We've stole her away from Iowa, and she's come down to participate. Just a quick rundown on the format. This is a call-in show. We invite your calls. You can have questions, comments, anything having to do with photography, 800-552-8502. So if you have a question, give us a call. Even tonight, nothing's too scary for us. At some point, we'll have a short segment on phone photography. And then, by and large, we're going to have just a conversation with Samantha. We put up some of Samantha's shots at the you can find them on the web at thebetterpicture.org. If you have access to a computer, if you're listening to us while you drive, wait till you get home, if you would, please. So let's get right to it. Samantha, welcome to The Better Picture.
Thank you, and I'm happy to be here.
Well, we are glad to have you here. We are glad to get you down from Iowa. You're probably glad to finally have a little cold snap in the weather.
I'm actually pretty happy about it. It feels like home again.
Yeah. Well, this is a show about photography, and I've invited you as a guest. But I have to just warn our listeners that you're not just a photographer. You teach graphic design.
Correct.
You are just recently won a sponsor's award for a painting at Art Space here locally.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, did you start off as a painter?
Actually, it wasn't my forte. My grandmother and my great-grandmother and my great-great-grandmother have all been painters, and actually my mother as well. So I've gone from quite a few generations, and I waited until I was a little bit older to dive in.
Well, it must have been a good dive, because I understand that you won an award and sold the painting.
So I did.
That is good. And then also, but you've been winning for a while. You, as a high schooler, were entering photographs in the Iowa State Fair, right?
Correct. I did, and my first entry actually won a bunch of awards.
So, at what age?
I think that one was actually in college, and I think I was about 18.
Okay. So you've done well. You come from a history of photography.
I do.
Your father was a photographer?
He was, very much so. So ever since he was probably about 16 years old, he was in it. I think for him, it was by choice. So it was just something he was interested in, and so he started photographing my mom, and that was the end of him and his hobby. It was all downhill and uphill at the same time.
Well, that is great, but he had a commercial studio.
After my brother and I were born, he was working at Wells Fargo, and he decided that that was not always going to be for him, so he started his own studio at our home. So.
And so when did you get your first camera?
Oh, I think I was about 12 years old when I got my very first one that wasn't a plastic toy one that you have when you're 2 years old.
Right. And did he train you, or did you just grow up absorbing it?
When he handed me my first camera when I was 12, there was a little beach area. It was called Sailorville Lake. It really wasn't a beach. It was right next to the lake, and it was kind of dumpy. But he'd walk us out there on Sunday afternoons, and he'd say, "Here's how you play with light. Now go." And we'd all show up to a Walmart later that afternoon, drop them all off, and wait a week or whatever it took at the time to get them back.
So in the growing up, it intrigues me that you had a professional,
right,
as a dad. I'm teaching you and I'm instructing you at that point in time. Did he work with you on composition, or was it more, this is the mechanics, let your eye develop?
He actually taught me the mechanics, and that first time we went out shooting, I don't think he necessarily expected me to get anything good. not to be mean, it was, you know, a 12-year-old girl with her first roll of film, and we went and picked him up from Walmart a week later, and he opened up everyone's, and because we were all like, whatever. And he opened up mine, and he went, "Oh, it's not fair." And I was like, "Did I do it wrong? Did I do it wrong?" And he goes, "No. You took better shots than me." And then that was just kind of, I think I just, he goes, you have an eye for it. And then that was it. I was hooked.
You were hooked at 12.
Yeah.
And as you progressed along, did you assist him in the business?
I did. He would shoot a lot of weddings. He would do some portraits, but mostly weddings. He would do a few, reunion type things, but the weddings were what I primarily helped him with. Otherwise, I did things on my own.
So you would help him with the weddings?
I did. My whole family would go along, my mother, my brother, and I, and we would... He'd prepare us almost more than the bride would prepare for her wedding. We would be the night before sitting together deciding, you know, who is going to stand where. How do you stay out of dad's way while he's getting the most important shots? How do you make sure that your camera is still running, you haven't run out of space, things like that.
And that was back shooting with film or with digital?
Digital at the time. Okay. We had expanded to that.
So, and how old were you when you were doing that?
I was probably about 18, 19 years old.
Well, that is true on-the-job training.
It very much is. It's a little high anxiety, but you'll get it.
Right. Well, you have to please not only your father, but the mother of the bride.
Exactly, exactly.
That's high-pressure learning, I can imagine. Well, what did you do in the way of formal education for photography?
I did go to a community college in my area once I did graduate high school, and I went there, and there was a photography program, and I didn't think much of it because I was just like, oh, I do this, I'll engage. And it ended up being one of my primary focuses because I loved it so much, and it was almost I used to tell everybody it was my easy A, so I would sign up for four of them, and then I'd sign up for my regular load. And it ended up being that I eventually got hired to teach a couple of the courses while I was attending one of my first degrees in college.
Well, you probably brought more experience into the classroom than most had. You had to face down a professional photographer who happened to be your father. And the nature of those courses that you were taking, clearly at that point you were beyond just technical. That had to be imagery and compositions and...
Our teacher, he taught a lot of classes based on the mechanics, and I was one of those kids that was sitting there. He'd ask a question, my hand would be up really fast. I'm like, I know the answer. And so eventually he was like, okay, we know you know what you're doing. Now do something better than what I'm trying to teach everybody else because you don't need this. And so it became that experimenting with speed, things going through that were in blur. How do you make it abstract? How do you play with the lighting? Things like that.
So you were getting college credits for playing with your camera.
Pretty much, yes.
Not bad work if you can get it.
Right.
I mean, that's a good way to have things done. And in those basically independent studies, what you're saying, you got your easy A's.
I did.
I understand.
And he also would bring me along on projects that he would do for his business as well. And so we would be out shooting calendars for people, or when we'd go on field studies in San Francisco or New Orleans or where did we go? South Dakota. He would assign us things, and then we would shoot it and hand it in to him as well.
Okay. Well, so that went on for how many years?
About 4 years while I was in college, because I continued to repeat my photography classes just so I could continue to stay there and play in the dark room. I loved that revolving door.
Oh, so, you had to be a student to have access to the dark room?
Yeah, pretty much. I think he would have let me stay, but I wanted to be a part of it, a reason to go and shoot every day.
Well, but if you were in a dark room, you were back to film at that point in studying.
He had a both digital and a film room, so you could go out and shoot your film. You could be in the developing, and then as soon as you were done, you could go out and play in the digital dark room as well.
And as you were first starting in photography, it was pure film.
It was for the college, that the way they taught. They wanted you to understand the aesthetics of knowing that you weren't necessarily going to get the shot unless you knew how to run your camera with digital. You can continue to take it and take it and take it until you get it right.
Right.
And so he forced you. You have 24 shots. You had 36 shots. You screw it up, you're a week behind in class.
Well, when you said you were growing up at home, that your dad y'all moved into the digital world.
Right.
But you started off with just film. That was
very much.
You started shooting before digital was really available.
Really, yeah.
So you have a preference?
I like the quality film gives. I love the static that's in it. I feel like it has a lot more depth. I primarily shoot digital now just because it's what's available and quick to go out and shoot with. But I always have a film with me backup just in case that itch happens. And I'm like, you know, no, we're going to do the rest of these in film.
Neil Johnson, in fact, our first guest on the show, always used the expression that, you know, when the muse takes over, you just have to follow her.
Pretty much, yes.
So you've got a film muse that rides in your camera bag?
Pretty much, and it's usually pretty heavy because I have, you know, my Nikon, my Canon, my Hasselblad, and then I have my digital with me. So I usually am carrying around an arsenal.
Well, one never knows what they're going to need when they get out into a setting. Do you generally go shoot assignments, or are you looking just to take your bag and go see what comes up?
When I first came down here, I just moved down here about a year ago. I set myself up to just go and explore the area. There was never a reason to just go someplace and plan on shooting this. I was purposely allowing myself to get lost so I could find my way home as I learned the roads here. And then I was teaching photography class, and one of my students started a club called F-Stop Mafia where they would start to create assignments for the month. And so I started to engage with that as soon as I got down here. But primarily, it's just me. It's just, let's go out. Let's go visit this place. Let's go down a road I don't know. So
now, prior to coming here to teach, you were in Iowa?
I was.
And were you teaching there?
I did teach as a graduate student at Iowa State University for a little while.
And graduate student in fine arts or in photography?
It was in graphic design.
Graphic design. Mm-hmm. Well, to me, it's an intriguing question. In graphic design, you start with an idea and a blank sheet of paper.
Right, right.
You've got to generate the stuff to put down. How does that play into how you work to compose a photograph? I mean, is it a different mindset that you go into whether you're photographing or drawing?
I think because I was in photography first, I understood the rule of thirds and shadow and composition, and so that played a lot of part into when I started studying graphic design, how I looked at how I designed for that. And then the two started to merge, and I started to look at what was aesthetically pleasing, not only to the point of shadow and things, but what also other people wanted to see in a photograph. So eventually it did start to evolve.
So when you teach, I mean, this is theoretically an educational program, and we're just getting free tuition here. when you teach in the photography classes that you teach, because you do teach photography as well as graphic design.
I do.
Do you bring in design elements to the kids as to students as to how you compose an image before you go shoot it?
We do talk about it for the quite a few of the first weeks. We talk about learning how to run your f-stop, your shutter speed, aperture, things like that. We talk about all of that and how each affects a photograph. But as I hand out the assignments to have them play with it, I ask them to be a little bit more creative and not just to understand how it works, but to actually get a photograph that is something that they could use later on. And so I start to ask them to actually think about that design.
And when you're teaching in the photographic world courses, are you going back and teaching with film?
Say that one more time.
Are you teaching? Are you starting your kids on film?
No, we start in digital. We just started this last year. As soon as I got here, I was walking through campus and there was a room that looked like it'd be a perfect dark room. And so I wrote a grant and got a $600 grant to start building a dark room on campus. So we've recently just purchased a bunch of enlargers. We have the sink set up. We have the trays. Right now we just need to attach all the lights and start getting some of the rest of the equipment in there, and it's ready to go.
You realize that will be one of the newest dark rooms created. I mean, some people are going to find them, and you're actually building one.
Right. Yeah,
that's a retro loop. And do you find the the students are intrigued by the idea of going back to film?
Actually, yeah. I've had a lot of students that go, oh, you taught photography last semester. Is it fun? And I say, oh, yeah, it's a lot of fun. Of course I'm going to say that. But also, we just opened up a new darkroom studio so we can go back to playing with film. And so I taunt that out there a little bit, and I think it excites them that they might get to play around in the darkroom with the chemicals and see how it actually works on that scale.
Well, I mean, it's hard to describe, and I think looking at the demographics of our audience, most of us either worked in a darkroom or shot film to start
right.
with. And it's hard to describe the smell of the fixer in watching that first image
right.
appear under that red light.
It's so thrilling, even if it is blurry and even if it is too dark. You're like, oh, man, that was so much fun. Let's do it again and let's get it right this time.
Well, there's also, you know, I was raised to believe you never get something for nothing.
Right.
But if you're clever enough and you're hardworking enough,
right,
you capture an image out of nothing.
I mean, right.
And produce it. It's a... Well, then you get to teach the different kinds of film and
right.
the different – I mean, to me, that was always one of the harder or more frustrating things with a film camera. I mean, I had one camera.
Right.
And you've got 36 exposure roll of black and white, and there's a beautiful sunset.
Right.
It's like, oh.
Why didn't I plan that better? Yeah.
Yeah. How do you get this in and out? Whereas – Of course, with a digital camera, you just change the white balance and
yeah.
Pick a different one, and off you go from there. Well, when you were shooting with your father, you started at 12. Here's a camera. Let's go to the lake and let's and shoot. Did y'all continue to do that?
Oh, very much so. Back in Iowa, where I was, grew up in a small town called Slater, Iowa. It's kind of right next to Ames, where Iowa State University is. And between Des Moines, you were just right in the smack in the middle. And there's a place called Ryman Gardens, and it was a butterfly garden. My dad would take us there every weekend. if it wasn't that, it was the Ledges, which was a neat outdoor park where you could climb up and up into a hill where the trees are, and we'd go out there and shoot. As well. So that, I guess we also, he'd take us to the zoo a lot, which is one of my favorite things. I always wanted to go to the zoo. I think it was just a kid thing. It was, I always wanted to be there.
For those of you tuning in late, my guest tonight is Samantha Barber, who is an assistant professor, graphic arts and photography at LSUS. We're here to answer any questions you may have. 800-552-8502. And we are, on air just to talk with you about cameras, either tips or good stories that you had with your own. In your trips to the zoo, mm-hmm. and your travels to the zoo, would your father actually teach you how to take pictures of animals, or he was more of a hands-off, figure it out?
He wanted to do his own thing, which was fine. It wasn't like a, you know, I'll let you see if you can swim on your own. It was just, I'm going to go do my thing, you go do your thing. And I think it allowed me to learn a little bit more on my own. So I retained a lot of the information. So I would look at my camera and I'd be, oh, well, that didn't turn out. How do I fix that? So it was more, I knew what I wanted when I was going into the zoo and I would just have fun.
Well, if you were shooting film in those days, it would probably also teach you some patience.
There's a lot of patience, and I think my dad was very OCD, and I got that from him, too. And so a lot of what he taught me was to pay attention to your surroundings, things that were happening, look for pattern, look for repetition. And so when I'd go out and we'd be shooting animals, I'd watch them for a while because I knew my shots weren't going to turn out if they were just walking back and forth. I need to understand what the pattern was at which they were moving, if they were going to hold still at a certain point. And so I would prepare for that quite often. And so I'd sit there and I'd sit there and I'd sit there, and people would be like, why isn't she taking her shot? You know, get out of the way, little kid.
Right.
And, I would wait, and then I'd see that animal stop right when I want him to, and he'd look my way, and that's when I would take my shot, and then I'd walk away.
One of the pictures that we, I think the Red River Radio put up on their page, was a great picture of a, it was like a goose.
Right.
That it's a mannerism that we've all seen, but probably don't know that we've seen it.
Right.
It's the stoppage in time at the critical moment.
Right.
You know, the decisive moment, I guess, Bresson would have said.
Sure.
How long did it take you to take that picture?
My dad took us out there, and it was one of the only times he took us out to this spot. And we sat out there, and I wasn't very enthusiastic about being out that day. It was a teenage moment. I just wanted to go home and snuggle under the blankets and read a book. And we're sitting there, and I took a few shots, and I thought the background was a little boring, so I didn't think anything was going to turn out anyways. So I sat down in the grass, and I started to watch the geese and how they'd move. And I'm like, you know, it would be so cool if I could catch it in motion as he's getting ready for flight. And so I sat there for maybe about 10 minutes and studying him. And then I watched this one specific goose because I knew he hadn't taken off in a while. And I sat there and I'm like, I'm going to be prepared for you. I'm looking at my background. This is it. This is where I'm going to be done. And that goose, he made that 1 foot motion. I go, here he goes. And I set myself up and I just continually pressed my shot until I knew that I got it.
And, of course, instructors teach preparation and timing.
Right.
You just went out and learned it on your own.
Pretty much, yeah.
You know, one of the lines that my listeners have heard before is, if you see the picture you want, you missed it.
Right.
I mean, it's all an anticipation or projection. And
right.
It's very hard to photograph a sport that you don't know.
Correct.
Or shoot a bird that you don't know.
Right.
Now, do you do animal photography now?
If I get to a zoo, yeah. Or if I'm out someplace that might have some more available / wild animals, not so wild. Back in Iowa, there were parks where we'd have buffalo that were wild, but, you know, there was a fence that kept them in a certain area. I'll go do that every once in a while, but I haven't had the opportunity to go very far while teaching and everything else that I've been involved with.
Well, I'm intrigued with a person that still carries a digital and a camera, a film, or two film cameras at the same time.
Right.
How do you decide what you're going to use? I mean, there's so many variables at that point. Which film you put in which camera,
right.
What format you're using. I mean, you've got a Canon, a Hasselblad, a digital.
Right, my Polaroid that I've now been playing with. That one's a lot more confusing than I thought it was. Yeah, I'm like, Polaroid Instant. No, it's not so much.
Right.
But, you know, I'll usually bring both, and I tell myself I'm going to look at my digital first. Lately, I think it's just I haven't played around as much as I would like, and so I feel a little bit rusty. And so I'll take a couple shots, but then my eye goes, oh, wouldn't that look great with that grainy film? Or if I get to play with the black and white and I can't force it to be in color. And so I'll switch automatically and just start shooting film. But I use it for those special shots now. It's not going to be something I'm going to repeatedly take the same shot of.
And if you see a photograph that, in the field, you'll make the decision there. That's mm-hmm. a black and white picture. That's not.
I do quite often. I tend to enjoy black and white a lot more. I do. I've been playing around with color as I've gotten older, but black and white always seemed to me, and I always told my teacher this was, it allowed for a different kind of passion to invoke and what, you know, other people are looking at it because you have to imagine a little bit more. So I liked the idea of just having the image, just the black and white, so you could think about it more than just.
Well, that's true. A black and white image, by definition, can't be pure representation.
Right, exactly.
Properly done color can.
Right. And I felt always when I was growing up that it could get a little bit boring. So I'm like, we see things in color every day. Why can't we look at it differently? So I would subtract all the color, and I'm like, wow, look at that.
Well, looking at your range of topics, which is phenomenal. I mean, it goes from the animals to models to brightly colored walls. I mean, you don't seem to be limited or inhibited by lack of subject matter to shoot. But in looking at your black and white, it appears that you push it up to an edge.
Mm-hmm.
You make a little contrast here, toss in a little extra grain. Some of the pictures actually are less contract almost soft, but none of it seems to be in the expected balance.
Right.
Is that an intentional thing that you're moving to?
I don't think it is. I think it's always just been me. And actually, I've always criticized myself for it a little bit because I see what other people are doing and I see their level of contrast between their blacks and their whites and their shadows. And I'm like, I gotta be that. And then whenever I look at my own film and start to maybe edit it digitally, I go, no, this is the way it was meant to be. This is the way I saw it. And so it ends up being whatever it was when I took that shot.
Well, I mean, personally, I wouldn't mess with what you're doing because it.
I appreciate that.
No, it's got a good balance. The gorilla picture. If you go to the betterpicture.org webpage, you can see it. You can't look at it without thinking of Rodin's thinker.
Right, right.
I mean, the fist is up there. The focus that goes out, and the depth of those blacks.
Right. You can see his fingerprints was what always thrilled me because I went to the zoo and I'd been there a zillion times it felt like. And the Omaha Zoo up in Nebraska is phenomenal. If nobody's ever been there, it is outstanding. And this gorilla, what they do is they have this enclosure where the gorillas follow you and you're basically in the enclosure. And so this gorilla was sitting there. And I'm like, oh, you're so beautiful. You're sitting right next to the glass. I'll go photograph you. And he sat there for me. And then all of a sudden, a bunch of little kids swarmed around me. And I'm like, okay, I'm done. You know, I'll go find another animal to shoot. So I walked around the enclosure and stood on the other side and kind of watched him and the kids. He got up and he was mad. And so he followed me over and he sat right back in front of me. And I was like, okay, I'll take a couple more shots. Again, the kids swarmed me, so I moved one more time back to where I was. And he followed me one last time. And he sat down and he went, oh. And he put his head on his, you know, his hand. And he was like, you don't understand this. And he looked at me like, it was almost like he did think that I understood. And so that's when I took, you know, I had my camera ready and I was like, you know, I'm going to capture this moment between you and I. And that was, I knew I was done after that. So you almost thank them sometimes. If you just say it real quietly, they don't maybe understand. You're just like, you know what? Thank you for that. I appreciate you.
Well, apparently he knew what a camera was and he was ready to talk to you and play with you. So that was. Those of you that heard the story, I recommend going to look at the picture because it makes it a whole lot more sense now to know that was a relationship. Because it did have an almost intimate feel. And that, when you're getting to, not your own dog.
Right.
But to an animal that you can't say, put your chin down, lift
up. Right.
How do you approach that other than patience?
I think ever since I was a kid, my mom will even tell you that I've always had an appreciation for animals and they've always seemed to come to me no matter what. It's a strange creature, a turtle, a fish. It was always, they came straight to me. So I don't know if it was a strange connection or what, but, I think it's if you treat them with respect and you understand that they're like people, they are who they are, and they each have their own personalities, they have those characters. So it takes a little bit of studying them to understand who they are. I have a giraffe one that I absolutely love, and I don't know that I sent it to you, but it's his back, and he's got his head turned to me. And he was so elegant and so refined, but he was in this dirty enclosure, and he was just like, I'm above all of this. And so that's when you capture those moments. You're like, that's who you are.
Well, and that's going back to both the muse being in the moment and keeping your eye open.
Right, always.
I mean, you can't say, I'm going to go get a picture of a gorilla thinking.
Right, no.
But you can see it develop, and you can see what's happening with that. Now, you mentioned that with the digital work, when you do your film, do you scan it and then process it on the computer?
When back in the day when I shot a lot more, what I would do is I'd go and develop it, and then I'd scan it in, and I'd clean up whatever dust was there. Right now, I haven't scanned in a lot of my film stuff lately, but that's the way that I would do it, is get a nice scan bed, or I would scan in my negatives and work from there. Sometimes I like working in the reverse.
But if you do that, you're not printing it through an enlarger at that point. You're on a
Right. I only scan them in if I want to show somebody what I've done in film. Otherwise, I have no interest usually in putting it out there as film turned digital, because it's always, I like the film aspect of it. It has a quality, and I feel like once you've brought it into the computer, it loses some of that.
So when you take a digital, take a film image,
mm-hmm.
and you scan it to work with it, if you're going to produce it, you go back in and print it.
Correct. I would do it back in the darkroom.
But you can't get any adjustments and clean it up and all the rest of that back to film, can you?
You mean clean it up and then put it in the computer, that
right.
sort of thing? Yeah. I suppose a lot of people would like and do like to have that cleanup, you know, get the dust off of it. It's who I am. I like it. It makes me feel like it's real again. It's not something that somebody goes, oh, well, they took 20 shots. It's back to being the one shot. It was perfect. The rest were probably not so great.
Right.
So
when you're teaching your children, I mean your students, that what advice do you give them on self-criticism and editing? We all have. I've got 150,000 pictures in a computer.
Right.
30 of them, I think, are pretty good.
Right.
But the ratio is just outrageous. Most of us out there in listening land have more pictures than we need.
Right.
How do you go about editing? How do you go about really breaking it down and
teaching them about that? A lot of it, because it's in the classroom, they have that ability to get feedback, not only from me, but from people of maybe their own age group or peers. And so what we do is we ask for that critical feedback. It's never, and we have this talk at the beginning of all my semesters, I said, here's the deal. I never want to hear you say, I like, because then they just stop at that. I want them to be able to say, I like it because it's working with your light here. And then I say, with that being said, I also want you to give feedback on what's not, because it's important for us to learn from one another. And so I say, but you got to be respectful. It's always about respect. I mean, you can think that something's terrible, but you can tell them why it's not working. I don't think it's working on this photograph because the blur over here doesn't make any sense. It's too much. You lose too much information. And so I ask them to start engaging in that conversation. And so with that, then they bring it back to when they're developing their own stuff at home and preparing to bring it into class. Well, I'm not going to show this one. I'm just going to go ahead and delete it. It's not right.
Right.
Because they've started to communicate that discussion with one another.
So you're doing both the technical side of it wasn't sharp focus.
Right.
As well as why is that pole in the picture?
Right, exactly. And so we'll have that conversation. I'm like, you took really beautiful shots this week, but this one is the one that's working the best. The other ones don't because of X, Y, and Z, but I like the attempt. And so in that you're complimenting, but you're not tearing down, but you're asking them to think, well, if I had to pick one, what would it be and why?
Well, as you progress along with this, I mean, in any photograph, you've got what's in focus, you've got intensity of the light, you've got the tonal qualities
right.
or the color images, you have the composition. There's so many variables that really make it snap
right.
To do that. Do you recommend that we actually go, as we look at our pictures and say, let's do focus, look at all the different
right.
elements and grade each one and say, if it had been in focus,
right.
it would have been perfect?
No, because I think, like you said, where I tend to take photographs a certain way, I criticize myself that I don't look like everybody else. There's a lot of photographers that I absolutely adore that have styles that I would never attempt, where everything's in blur, where it's very, there's a lot more gray. I like heavy blacks and I like heavy whites in my photographs. And so I wouldn't say ever stop yourself from, you know, doing something, but just critique it. Is it what you wanted? Was it what you expected? Could it have been better? And then if you answer yes or no to that, depends on whether or not you keep it.
That's finding your own voice.
Right, and, exactly.
I mean, in what I've looked at yours, and I've enjoyed all of it, there's not a lot of negative space. You fill right. up a frame.
I normally, yeah, I do. I mean,
which is a style.
Right.
I mean, it's a very active style. When you go to look through the viewfinder and pick out the pictures, do you go to the corners or do you start to the middle and go out? I mean, how do you, or is it the whole thing looks right?
Well, if I'm going out, like, say, on a Saturday afternoon, I'm just shooting downtown Shreveport or something, I drive by and I think I just automatically have a frame in my head and I see it from an angle and I go, that was it. Back up my car about a foot and a half. I'm like, and then like, nope, it was about 2 inches more forward. And I go, that's where I want it. And that's it. I think that's it. And then after I've maybe taken that shot where I go, that's what I wanted, I look at it and I go, oh, well, somebody's Christmas ornaments were in the back. I don't want that. I need to reset myself. Or I really would like to get the clouds a little bit more texturized. Let me reshoot that at the same angle. And so then I start to play with it after that.
Well, that's and that's one of the things, I think, a lesson that's a takeaway from the show tonight is 2 inches or 6 inches movement can completely change.
It does. It dramatically. I mean, if you go back to when my dad and I shot my first set of film, we were on the same beach. But he liked my shots better. Well, maybe I was 3 foot shorter, so maybe that was what made the difference. But I was seeing it from a different angle, and we just shot different right. things. So.
And are there times that you look and go, man, if I was 3 feet taller, I could see
it. I sure do. I was actually out this weekend with my boyfriend shooting, and he's a little over 6 foot. And we were taking pictures of each other, and I wanted to get this light on his face, and so I had to do that live view on the back of my camera and hold it above my head. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I'm too short. Don't judge me.
Right. Well, just joining us, our guest tonight is Samantha Barber. We are in the middle of our show, 800-552-8502. If you have a question, we did have one emailed question in from Canada that came in that it is an age-old problem. And the question was, how do you get a good picture of your black Labrador Retriever running through white snow? You know, obviously, you're fond of the dog and want all the texture.
Right.
What's the basic approach to that?
The way that I would approach it is know that I automatically am going to have a good contrast. So I know that everything else after that is, in my mind, going to be easier to set up. Snow has a reflective quality, so it's bringing a lot of light into the situation. So I would aim for a light for the dog so that he was lighter, and then worry about the snow later, because the snow is always going to kind of appear as a little bit more white, depending, unless you really undershoot, and then it becomes a gray massive.
Right. Well, that is a problem in general. If you're just letting your camera average the light out,
right,
it's going to tend to underexpose because there's so much light does come off the snow.
Right. So you have to almost aim at I would aim at the snow too, and trick the camera into thinking how bright it is, and then mess with it from
right.
there.
And in the digital world, I've found that you can go back and retrieve data
right.
out of the darks, the shadows.
Right.
But once you've blown out the image,
it's gone.
I mean, unless you're getting the little crystals on the top
right.
of the snow. Blowing that out a little bit's okay.
Right.
It's
right,
just white.
Right, exactly. It's not you're not looking for a detail.
And one of the things for those of you out there that are looking at pushing your camera to take photos instead of snapshots, really consider shooting in RAW format
mm-hmm.
instead of JPEG. And just very briefly, the difference is the camera is a computer. I mean, it's a processor. And the sensor gathers all this information. And for space-saving purposes, the JPEG, which is the most common photograph taken digitally, it makes decisions for you.
Mm-hmm.
And, for example, the camera that I have sitting here in a RAW format is a 42-megapixel picture,
right.
which is enormous. In a JPEG, it's about 8 to 12.
Right.
And what that means is you've lost that data. And if you get back into processing the case, the picture later, and you want to find something in those shadows, it's probably in there in RAW. It's probably been thrown away in JPEG.
Right.
So if you're out doing that with the pictures, a lot of them now, the cameras have this high dynamic range, HDR. And the basic problem is your eye can see lights and shadows and your brain can accommodate it. The camera sensor doesn't. It can only have a certain range that it can see and put it back together. Your brain may actually analyze different parts of the picture you're seeing through your eyes. And in HDR, the cameras do that. Mm-hmm. They analyze the sky and say, ah, that's a sky. Tone it down some. That's a mountain. Bring it up some. Mm-hmm. So check your HDR. I mean, the advice I give you is read the manual that came with your camera that's still wrapped in the plastic. You know, we all pick up a camera and go shooting with it, but read it because that's how you get the image of that dog. If you spot meter to the dog, you don't see a grain of anything in the snow.
Right.
If you spot meter to the snow, the dog becomes a shadow.
Right.
So you have to make some compromises.
You do, and you have to understand how to play with that.
Right, and how you do that. One of the things that we always do on the Better Picture is we try to give you a smartphone tip. And as Samantha was just saying, that, you know, you pick out what you want in focus, you pick out how you want things to do. The good thing about a smartphone is those cameras are amazing and they can get everything in focus and you can pick it up, point and push, and everything's there. The bad thing about the camera is you pick it up and point, everything is there. So it's hard to get things out of focus. And it is so critical. I think the Apple has come out with two lenses now.
Right.
And they actually takes two pictures. It, much like a JPEG, decides I'm going to have the face in focus and everything else behind it out.
Right.
You can do it with software. You can smudge the stuff behind it. It doesn't have that same creamy quality as if you can get it out of focus. So here's the trick for Halloween on that. It takes a little practice. The smartphones, iPhones, Samsung, Galaxies, all of them, they only have a certain amount of depth of field and how much you can put in focus. And when you get up close to something, it's going to focus to that, and by definition, the stuff behind it's going to be out of focus. But you usually fill the frame up. Well, you remember our tricks from past shows where you can tap on the phone and set the focus? This is what I call sneaker zoom. You get up close to the person's face, and you tap the phone, you get the focus, and then take two quick steps back and take the picture. And what happens is, they're still within what the camera can capture, but the wall or the forest or the mountains behind it aren't, and they go soft. And it takes a little practice, and here's your real trick. Practice at home. Set up a lamp with a wall 10 or 15 feet behind it, something on the wall that'll show you if it's in focus or not, and practice as to how far you can back up. It's not precise, but if you want to get past that, then you're going to need to get a camera that you can change the f-stops on. You're going to need to get a camera that you can do, you know, more manual adjustments or some lenses that add on or some sophisticated software. Don't take your smartphone and buy a bunch of stuff to make it a regular camera. Right. Go get a regular camera. And I mean, it does what it does well.
It does. It's accessible. It's in your pocket at all times. It's nice to have a real camera and get that other shot.
Right. It does. There are many photographers, national photographers, professionals have said, you know, that the iPhones, one of the Galaxy, are some of the best cameras on the planet because you have them with you.
Right. At all times. You capture that moment that will never be captured again.
Oh, I remember many, many pictures I didn't take.
You always remember those because they'll never come back.
They don't come back. They don't at all. Now, you also not only do animals, but you do the human animal. You do people.
I do.
What are some tips and tricks for bringing out the personality, not just taking a picture of the baby,
right,
but to get the personality out of somebody?
You know, that's always been a hard one for me, because people scare me more than animals do. And so when I was growing up and I was starting to do more portrait photography in college, there were classes where you had to do studio shots. You had to be in the studio with somebody else, and you had to do it with somebody you didn't know. And so learning to tell them to move so you could get your right light. A lot of my teachers forgot to tell you, we're not just worried about the technical, you need to look at that personality. And I think once I figured out that they taught me the technical and I needed to understand the subject is when it started to become a little bit more eye-opening. And what I would start to look at is the eyes. It was kind of like with the animals. You kind of stay movement, behaviors, you listen to what they talk about, what they're passionate about. And you, if you want to engage with that personality, you make conversation. And I think then it starts to develop in your shots.
But at that point, you're comfortable enough with your technique.
Right, right. It has a lot to do with your technique, very much so. I have my students practice both photographing, you know, they kind of start to develop at home, doing a few things at home. And then I actually ask them to go out and photograph strangers on the street. And we have a large discussion over how do you capture personality with people that you've never met. And we have this discussion about how do you approach somebody, how do you start to engage in that conversation that they allow you to take a picture that's not just going to be the typical iPhone shot where you're smiling and you have, you know, a little bit of their chest and not chopping off their head. And we say, how are you going to talk to this person? Are you going to ask them not to smile, pretend they're talking to you? How do you start engaging that?
Right. I mean, to me, the black and white portrait photographer, the Josef Karshes and the rest of those old-time guys, that's the highest form of art.
Right.
With the camera, because you're suspending the reality by going to the black and white, and then you're trying to extract the personality.
Right.
And the lighting there is the critical portion.
It is. Once you've got that, I always kind of go back to that saying, you know, the eyes are the windows to the soul, and so I ask my students to think about that. I don't know if that's always right to tell them to look at that, but I ask them, you know, look them in the eye and try to understand that.
Right.
I think if you can look them in the eye, then you know a lot more about them than you think you do.
And
we got actually an online question for you.
Oh,
you want to take one there, Ross?
All right.
Okay. So this question is, in the old film days, I could push an ASA setting, so that's got to be old time.
Right.
I'll let you explain that.
Right.
And can you do that with a digital camera?
Do you want to?
You take
go?
It.
You can mess with a lot on the digital cameras nowadays, and a lot of things have changed via terms, but it's all there.
Right. And the ASA... the explanation is that's just the sensitivity of the film or of the sensor as to what you could do. The standard we were growing up was Tri-X, which was an ASA 400, which was a real fast film.
Right.
But it had a lot of grain. Mm-hmm. And the reason is in film, you actually had the sunlight or the whatever light source burning silver and chemically altering the film and as to what happened. And it just took a lot of light to burn the. Well, now with the in the digital world, I saw 125,000 ISO, the ASA, which is 16 stops faster than Tri-X. You know,
right?
That's black cats at night with shadows.
Right.
Probably very grainy. I mean, there's a trade-off when you get to that. So, yes, the answer to the question is you can increase the speed, and that's one of the advantages of the digital is if the light starts going down and you're halfway through a roll of film, then you basically either have to rewind it and hope you don't lose half the roll or quit taking the pictures or get them blurry and it doesn't work well. With the digital, you can say, I need a more sensitive film.
Right.
And you can turn it up. So, yeah, you can push it. Mechanically, electronically, the new cameras, the high-end cameras, beat the socks off of the old film world. My camera here has more resolution, more information in it than Kodachrome does.
Right.
You can adjust the white balance. You know, if you have an outdoor film that you take pictures inside, they're going to be orange. You know, whereas this, I can say I'm inside now, and it adjusts if it doesn't do it automatically. So, yeah, you can do a lot more, but you get computer feel instead of film.
You do, and I think once you get some of the stuff that's going a little bit faster and get a little bit more pixelization sometimes.
Right.
And pixelization to me is worse than grain in film. I would rather accept the grain than I'd accept a pixel.
Well, let's talk for a little bit of the time we have remaining. In post-processing, you know, I've seen programs out now that say take a raw image and treat it like Tri-X, and it simulates the grain, which covers up some of the pixelization. I haven't seen it do it as well, but it
does it.
It gets pretty close.
It does.
You can change Vivia, Kodachrome, Ektachrome. You can electronically dial in what you want with that. How much post-processing do you do in a digital image?
Primarily, if I'm going to go in and edit anything, it's just I want to play around with the contrast because I try to get the color and the light balance right when I'm out there because then I know it's okay. It's good. So if I'm going to go into the computer, it's going to be, I really want this to be black and white. I really want the blacks to be a little bit deeper. I want the whites to be a little bit whiter. And so I think there's not a lot of post-production. I might crop an image, but I'm not going to spend 15, 20 minutes on one image. I might spend 2 to 3, maybe 5 if it's one that's just been fighting me, but otherwise just 2.
Well, now some of the images that I've seen of yours, much like the black and white, even in the color, will move off just a little off of what is natural to mine.
Right.
Which in every one that's different is a perceived effect.
Right.
The colored wall that goes down with all the colors, that's pretty true.
Right.
Whereas you've got some others that it looks like you've either desaturated or oversaturated.
Right.
And what that means for our listeners is, in saturation, you can do it on your smartphone. It just increases the amount of every color, or you can select certain colors that you want to, or you can, if you completely desaturate a color photograph, it turns into black and white.
Right, right.
It drops out the color elements themselves. So you get to fool with that some. Yours, do you see that in the field going, gosh, if I could just...
I think a lot of times, like if you look at people, if you go out and you take a shot of somebody, you're like, I know that this is about as good as I'm going to get, but in my shot, I know I don't want them to look like an Oompa Loompa when I'm handing over their film. So I know that I'm going to have to go in there and say to my saturation, you know, I want a little bit less red, a little bit less orange and yellow, and start to pull out that blue, which could be caused by lighting. And so often I see what I want, and I say, okay, well, that's achievable with a few edits. Take it. And I probably stop about there. I don't put a lot of thought into it besides what I see. It's either right or it's not for me.
But you'll see an image. If I can kick the contrast on that, that's going to be what I want.
Right, exactly. Exactly. If I see somebody and I've got a shadow and we're out in the woods and, you know, there's lights coming through the trees, I go, oh, well, that was really great. I like the contrast on their face, what's in focus, what's not. But I know if I go into the computer and bump up the saturation, those greens are going to allow this person to pop a little bit more, but I'll take care of that later.
Yeah. But you've seen it. That was Ansel Adams' thing. You don't click the shutter till you know what the final print's going to look like.
Right, exactly.
So, I think you have to start when you're 12 to be able to do that. Most of us haven't quite gotten to that point yet. Well, you talked about cropping. Do you sometimes, if you have the wrong lens or if you've got your phone or something else, go, I like the middle part of that picture, I'm going to go ahead and take it and I'll just come to it later?
I do that quite often. I actually shoot bigger and then come down if I'm shooting people or a house or something, what I often do is, you know, that might need to be an 8x10 later. Well, that's going to be awkward because the picture size is different. I need to be prepared for that crop. And so I'll often shoot the one I want for digital, and then I'll shoot wider for something that I might need to crop down for a print that somebody might want later.
It's a lot easier to cut off a little bit of cloud than to put somebody's top of their head back
exactly.
on it.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that is a good point that most people don't understand. A 4x5, a 5x6, a 4x6 and an 8x10, a 5x7, they're all different ratios.
They are, very much so.
And so if you have a negative that's a great 5x7 and say, I want to blow it up to an 8x10.
It doesn't work the same.
it's not going to work. So, that is good. You've also done some beautiful work with flowers and shadows and all of that. Are those the kind of things that just stop you in your track, or do you actually say, I'm going to move this tulip over here? And
No, whenever I shoot a flower, it's always I just walk around until I see the one that's in the position. It's kind of like looking at the background. I want the Christmas ornament in there. I don't want the dead field behind me. I want the green grass. And so oftentimes it's a luck when it comes to flowers. Missing petal, there's a ladybug, and so on.
Right. And do you find yourself excluding stuff more or moving to get stuff into the picture?
I like things to be out of the way. I don't want a blade of grass oftentimes in the way. But when it comes to flowers, I also like to shoot on their level. And so oftentimes I like to get on the ground and get in the perspective of them.
Okay, well, I always ask my guests, if given the chance, what one piece of advice would you give a photographer?
Always keep shooting and never stop believing in yourself to get to where you want to be. I'm never as perfect as I want to be with it, so I'll always continue to try to be better.
Well, that is good advice, and that fits right in with our motto of get close, stay focused, and keep shooting.
Right.
Sincere thanks to guest Samantha Barber for spending her Halloween here with us. Thanks also to Kermit and Wally and Lillian for being here to help produce this and put it together. And remember, get close, stay focused, and keep shooting. We'll see you on the next Better Picture.